Production and distribution of City Club Forums on IdeaStream Public Media are made possible by PNC and the United Black Fund of Greater Cleveland Incorporated.
Hello. Hello, everyone. Hello, and welcome to the City Club of Cleveland, where we are devoted to conversations of consequence that help democracy thrive. It's Wednesday, November 30th, and I'm Melissa Raybuck, Communication and Program Innovation Manager here at the City Club. I'm pleased to introduce the David Ralph Hertz Memorial Forum on Civil Liberties, featuring Fatima Goss Graves, President and CEO of the National Women's Law Center. This summer, the Supreme Court's decision in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization completely altered the legal landscape for access to abortion. Nearly 50 years earlier, Roe v. Wade seemed to enshrine abortion protections, but the recent decision has shifted the power back to the states, creating a patchwork of protections and prohibitions, with the latter disproportionately impacting minority and low-income individuals. The National Women's Law Center was founded in 1972 and has been a leader in legal and public policy advances that have dramatically improved the lives of women and their families for 50 years. Our speaker today, Fatima Goss Graves, is a nationally recognized leader in the fight for gender justice and an expert in law, policy, and culture change. She is president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center, president of the National Women's Law Center Action Fund, and co-founder of the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. She has appeared as a legal commentator and published on multiple national news outlets and is a graduate of UCLA and the Yale Law School. Moderating the conversation today is Helen Forbes Fields, president and CEO of the YWCA of Greater Cleveland. Prior to taking the helm at the YWCA this summer, Ms. Forbes Fields spent over 31 years practicing law at the Forbes, Fields, and Associates law firm and served as the executive vice president and general counsel of the United Way of Greater Cleveland. Ms. Forbes Fields is a graduate of Spelman College and the Howard University School of Law. So, with the future of legal protections for abortion increasingly uncertain, what are the legal strategies that are being developed and deployed to address these growing concerns? If you have a question for our speaker, you can text it to 330-541-5794. That's 330-541-5794. You can also tweet your questions at the City Club, and our staff will try to work it into the second half of the program. Members and friends of the City Club of Cleveland, please join me in welcoming Fatima Goss Graves.
Well, it's wonderful to see everyone here today, and I know this is absolutely a topic that's on the forefront of all of our minds as we heard about the Dobbs decision this summer. Fatima, as I was reading about the work that you do and the work that we do here at the YWCA, I saw that we really closely align in terms of our mission. At the YWCA, our focus is really to eliminate racism and to empower women and girls. And reproductive rights are very important to us. Supporting women is crucial to us. So why don't you tell us all here about the work that you're involved in at the Law Center and how you are working to lift women out of poverty?
Well, I am so very glad to be here, and what an honor to be in conversation with you, Helen. And so at the National Women's Law Center, we like to say we fight for gender justice, and we do it in the courts. We do it as advocates for laws and policies that change the lives of women and girls, and that's true at the national and state level. And we engage in conversations with the public using a range of cultural means. We're trying to meet people where they are. And we work across the lives of women and girls, We focus on what it looks like to have access to education where young people can learn with safety and dignity and equity. We focus on what it looks like to actually have work, where people can work with the sort of wages where they can support their families and do that with safety and dignity and equity. We work to ensure that our families who are on the brink of poverty or in poverty can be supported, including on the things like the tax and budget policies that make a difference to support those programs. And we, since our founding, have worked on healthcare, including reproductive healthcare. And I am so, you know, I'm super familiar with the YWCA nationally and the work you all have been doing here, and it's not lost on me that sometimes people think about these issues as dramatically siloed, but what we know is that in people's lives, it's not at all siloed, right? It is the same communities that are facing harm and attacks in so many areas of their lives. And so we use the tools that we think will make the biggest difference in any given moment to drive change.
Well, before we talk about those various tools, but first I want to say welcome to Ohio.
And I will just tell you, I have felt very welcomed while being here. This has been great.
That's because it's Cuyahoga County. Let's just say Ohio, I think, is our perfect case study for our discussion today, right? The changing landscape of reproductive rights. And I hope I didn't hurt anyone's feelings if they weren't from Cuyahoga County, please. You know, as we talk about changing landscape of reproductive rights, I was thinking about our topic as I was preparing for today, and I thought, you know, it's really not changing landscape. It's about the decimation of reproductive rights. And how did we get here? Let's level set. How did we actually get here, Fatima, where we had a constitutional right that was in place for almost 50 years? And our U.S. Supreme Court has completely eradicated that constitutional right. How did we get here at this moment?
Well, that's absolutely the question we all have been asking. And there's lots of ways to answer it. It's possible, I guess I could say we got here because 50 years ago, a group of people following the Roe decision decided they would dedicate their life, resources, and talents to undermining it. And so maybe we've always been headed here. And I resonate with that because I will tell you on June 23rd or June 24th, I made the same dedication that the Dobbs decision would not stand in the way that we are experiencing it. So I resonate with whatever group of people made that decision 50 years ago. You might argue that the way that we got here is that over the last five decades, we have allowed the right to abortion to be separated from access to abortion. And here's what I mean by that. You know, there were some parts of the country where Roe had been the law for 50 years. They understood that. But abortion access was not available in their community. Clinics had shut down. People couldn't afford it. And there was a longtime rule called the Hyde Amendment that had been put on every appropriations bill that meant our lowest income families couldn't use the health insurance they had to cover it. And so maybe that sort of both legal and cultural stigmatizing of abortion access, a procedure that one in four women in this country get, maybe that's how we got here. So I've been thinking about that. I've been thinking a lot about the 2016 election. And in part because that was an election in which the popular vote went one direction. That was an election where in the backdrop, although not very loudly, but the backdrop was that there was an open seat on the Supreme Court. You may remember that now Attorney General Merrick Garland had been nominated for that seat and never received a hearing. And so for a year, that seat wasn't filled, and the country didn't uprise over it. That should have been a signal that maybe something was coming. And I really think the dramatic remaking and reshaping of the Supreme Court, where there are three new Supreme Court justices confirmed in a four-year period, that reshaping so quickly is the reason it feels also unsettling. In this country, we haven't seen very many times where you have woken up one day and the state of the law has been pretty clear, and the next day, the state of the law has been so chaotic. And that's how people feel in this moment. And that's how people feel whether or not they support abortion access. For those who are lawyers, people like to be able to rely on precedent, to be able to give your client some sort of sense of the boundaries and the direction. That's how you give good advice. And this is a time where people aren't sure, and the reason that they aren't sure, because the usual norms and the usual ways of doing things and the usual understanding about how the Supreme Court understands and deals with precedent, it's all been shifted. And so that feels chaotic and disconcerting. And then the thing that I will say is, over the last decade, state after state have used abortion access as a tool to rile up a small part of their political constituency by passing laws that restrict abortion access. For a long period of time, they would do it in the name of protecting women's health. What would happen was they'd say, well, and we saw this in the whole women's health decision from 2016, they would say, well, you know, women don't really know how to make these decisions, so we are going to pass these laws that shut down all the clinics in the state for their protection. Or we're going to set up a series of rules so that providers can't really actually have admitting privileges to hospitals, and also require that they have admitting privileges to perform care in their own clinics. So setting up hurdle after hurdle, that's what they used to do. After Justice Kavanaugh was confirmed, that totally shifted. That was the year where states just started saying, we're just banning abortion. We are just going to ban abortion outright. And then the race was at what point? Is it 15 weeks? Is it 12 weeks? Is it 8 weeks? Is it 6 weeks? Is it zero? Mm-hmm. So we have found ourselves here. A lot of people have focused on the last year. But for those who've been working deeply in the movement, and I see in this room that some of you, you've known this was coming for a long time. You just didn't know when. And on the last year, there were all of these points that made it clearer and clearer, right? Whether it was that when the Texas SB8 decision was allowed to go into effect, and in the middle of the night, a really unusual process, the Supreme Court just allowed it to go into effect, which shut down abortion access effectively in that state. Or the oral argument, where many of us listened to it and thought, oh my goodness, there's no way to count to a majority despite our precedent. Or maybe the draft opinion we all had, that might have been the sign that it was going to happen. You don't usually get a full rough draft to review that really only changed by a few pages. So many of the parts were kept that many of us thought, there's no way they're gonna actually keep the long references to 19th century norms as our guide, and they kept that. So we're here. We are at this moment that has long been predicted. It is worse than the predictions in terms of the legal chaos and the public health chaos.
Yeah. And I think about the patchwork of laws and regulations that you find across the country. I mean, here in Ohio, the day that Dobbs was decided, the very next day, the heartbeat law went into effect, the 6-week ban on abortion. And you think about the amount of chaos and confusion that created, clinics being on the verge of closing. And then we had a slew of lawsuits. The ban right now is on hold while we run through the appellate process. But people are totally confused. Right now, abortion is legal in Ohio up until 22 weeks, but I dare say if you go out on the streets, most people wouldn't understand that right now. And I think to some point, that's, at some process, that's really the point, right? Yeah. To create such confusion so that essentially you don't get access.
Yeah, that you're exactly right, that the confusion and chaos and fear really is a part of this time. You know, we are hearing from providers around the country who have talked about, you know, what it has been like to go in and out of business depending on the hour of the day and having to call all of your patients and say, yes, we can schedule you, and then call them and say, we're wrong, we can't schedule you, we have to try to divert you to other places, the trauma that individuals who are just seeking care, what they are experiencing in that time, you know, belief of you either have to travel or maybe you don't have to travel, confusion around whether or not you can legally access medication, abortion, and that confusion, I will say, extends from this sort of solo provider or individual who's just trying to figure out the care they need to really large companies who are trying to figure out what are the set of rules I have to operate on. We've been in tough conversations and sometimes with pharmacies who have taken steps that they don't have to take because of the law, but people are making predictions, unsure of what the state of the law is, and we have a lot of work to do to explain to the general public what the state on the ground is in every community, and that is hard to do when it changes day to day.
Yeah. Well, not only that type of confusion in terms of just accessing abortion, you have to think about an economic impact or the impact on the medical profession. How are you looking at this across the country? I mean, it was just announced we're bringing in Intel in Southern Ohio, but I have to believe some of those potential employees would be troubled about where the state of Ohio is headed with this measure. So what are you seeing across the country?
So, you know, this is a situation where a number of companies did speak out around the time of the Dobbs decision. And the way, if you listen to pretty closely to what they said, they talked about their workforce. They were speaking out because they worried about their ability to recruit and retain a workforce. That didn't happen accidentally. They were hearing from their employees that they were expecting their companies to do something about it. For companies that operate around the country, or in some cases around the globe, some of them said, well, you know, maybe we can allow you to transfer or leave your state, but people don't want to just get up and leave their community. They want to fight to be in the communities that they grew up in, where they have family and other relationships. What they're really asking their companies to do is fight on their behalf. And so this is going to be a real test for the corporate community, whether or not they will be willing to show up for their employees in a different way than they have on this issue. And I will say we've, you know, you may have seen many companies make announcements around their benefits policies. That conversation isn't beginning and ending there. We are hearing from employee groups, employee resource groups, who are saying, we expect more. So that's one thing. But I actually think the talent competition is another thing that companies are going to be listening to. And I, you know, I will just name, my family lives in Michigan. I have seen the, I would almost call it trolling, that has been happening from some folks in Michigan, where they're kind of like, well, come here. we can offer you something different. And I actually think that you might see more of that type of competition. In the same way, you have some company, some states who are trying to draw companies in with a battle for, you know, tax benefits. You're going to have company. You're going to have states trying to draw companies in with a battle for talent. That we are going to be a place where your workforce is going to want to live. And then the last thing that I just have to name, you know, we spend our time thinking a lot about those who have the least access to resources, and that is who I wake up and think about in this time. This is not a situation where people can very easily, at a moment's notice, just get up and leave the state to access abortion care. Most people in this country do not work for companies that provide paid sick time to do something like that. Most people in this country who have abortions already have children. So they have to find a way to access childcare. Most people are not sitting on dollars to be able to fund the health care and the travel costs that they should be able to just get in their own community. So this is also for those who have the least amount of economic stability are being put in a position where their road is being made much harder.
Yeah. I mean, we continue to see inequity in terms of who will continue to have access and those that will not.
For
no
sure.
Doubt. So let's talk about some of the misconceptions about abortion in terms of who really is accessing abortions and what the reasons are in terms of receiving that type of care.
So I really like to begin by saying the reason people access abortion care is because they no longer want to be pregnant. I mean, that's the reason. Mm-hmm. Now, I wish I could actually begin and end the sentence there, mm-hmm. in part because I think the backdrop of this is that people don't actually really trust women to make that decision. And so they want to know really, really why is it a good enough reason. And so the big reason, the fundamental reason, is that they no longer want to be pregnant. But there's a whole range of reasons. Sometimes it's that they already have children and they know that they can't handle another child. Sometimes they're in a relationship that is abusive or ending, and they don't want to have a child with that person. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they've experienced violence. Sometimes they are at a point where they're about to make a big change in their life. Maybe they're going to school. Maybe they're starting a new job. Sometimes if they have a pregnancy, their health will be in deep jeopardy. Sometimes it is that they're told that their pregnancy is not viable and they don't want to stay pregnant with a non-viable pregnancy. Sometimes it is their age. They're very, very young. And many of you guys, I'm sure, followed closely. People were stunned that there was a story in discounting the idea of someone who could be pregnant under the age of 12. I'm not sure why people were surprised by that, because what we know is that there are rates of assault against young people under 12, and some of those result in pregnancies. Another very high rate of unintended pregnancy, I will tell you, is for people who are kind of around my age and thought they could no longer be pregnant. So the reasons are varied and many, and many more than I have named. But the bottom line is, one in four women in this country have accessed abortion care. And we shouldn't pretend like that is not a fact. And I trust them to make the decisions that they need to make for themselves and for their families. And I trust them far more to make those decisions than I trust politicians to be in the middle of those decisions.
I think what's going on as well, Fatima, is that abortion is such a stigma. I was with a conversation just the other day, and there was a whole conversation about it being such a stigma, even in discussions. Give us some direction in terms of how we should talk about abortion in a very authentic way when we're engaging with our own families and friends and other stakeholders that we engage in. How do we have that discussion?
So I will tell you, at the National Women's Law Center, we've spent a lot of time on this, in part because we are an organization that is a multi-issue organization. We work deeply with people who work on tax policy. We work deeply with people who work on childcare policy, who might work on organizing workers who dominate women professions, and who mostly don't work on reproductive health care as an issue. And what, you know, this might seem controversial to some, but I think a mistake that our broader movement has made, in part out of protecting ourselves, it has been that it has been too separate from the many other issues that are critical to the lives of women and girls. And I want to be clear that I'm using women and girls because I think the reason that people are passing these laws, in part, is to control the lives of women and girls. I think that is what is behind that. And so I think if you're working on other issues, it's time to become knowledgeable and fluent and engaged in the issues of reproductive rights and health, even if you haven't been before. It's time. And it is time for our movement to make it easy for people to do that, to catch them up on data and also on language. You know, there's been a lot of conversation around stigmatizing language that has been used over time. And our movement has said, we're going to ask people to stop using some of that. And I'm going to give you an example. For a long time, a lot of beloved politicians had sort of a saying. And it went something like this, that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. And I've had a lot of people ask me, what's wrong with that? Isn't that true? It should be safe, legal, and rare. And part of what I've been really honored to be in conversation with people about is that talking about it as safe, legal, and rare gets you right into a conversation that starts judging the decision-making of people who are seeking care. Abortion should be accessible for people who need it. Period. Like, I can also end that sentence, right? The other thing that I will just say, and I will put it very directly on the table, I think we have to make a lot more room for people to evolve on this issue. You know, it's one thing when something is clearly embedded in our laws and have been for half a century, which I just want to remind everyone, that's a really long time in a nation that's not old. 50 yeah. years is a long time for our nation's history. It's really hard to tell people, you know, I want one of your top five issues, I want you to fight for the thing you have. That's a weird thing to ask people to do. And young people in particular, when we'd be in this conversation, we're kind of like, no. We want to fight for climate change. We want to fight around student loans. We have ideas that are forward-looking. We're not interested in fighting the fight you won 50 years ago, which I think is fair for people to decide that. But at the same time, we're in this moment where the stigma is so well worn, we aren't even being honest about the state of play. We aren't being honest about the numbers of people who access care. We aren't being clear about how people make that decision. And we aren't sort of saying when it is that people are doing things that make, that push abortion care into the shadows. And the way I knew that we were gonna face a bit of a change in that was after the Dobbs leak, people would spontaneously tell me their abortion stories. I was not asking people for their abortion stories. But I would be in rooms, in settings with many different types of people, mostly who were not tied to the work, and they would tell me, sometimes in whispers, their abortion stories. The only other time I had that happen was when Me Too went viral, and people in whispers would tell me their stories of surviving sexual violence. And at that moment, I was reminded that we had so stigmatized abortion that people thought they were alone, that they were the only one, and that their stories deserved to be in the shadows, similar to the way we stigmatize sexual violence. And I feel like part of the path forward is creating space and conditions for people to talk about their own experiences on the terms that matter to them and to be met with something meaningful.
Well, I know that we're about to take audience questions, and can I ask one last question, Alyssa?
Yeah.
I had a whole ton of questions.
I told Helen I'm a slow talker.
And I was so worried that we would whip through my questions, but Fatima and I talked about it's time for us to get out of our pity party about the Dobbs decision. And I'd love for you to just give us some advice here in Ohio about how we can work to make sure that we can ensure access to abortion going forward in the state of Ohio.
Yeah, I mean, it was traumatic and upsetting. And I know folks have been going through various stages of grief. So I don't want to minimize that. And it's time, everybody. Like, everybody has to get to work, despite it. So I as I told Helen, I tell my kids, I'm like, you know, we have big feelings right now, and we can have them for another day or so. But then we're like, y'all, we got to get going. So I have been thinking a lot about states like Ohio that have a couple of features that we need to actually be real about. So features where there has been such a gerrymandered situation in state capitals where the majority will isn't heard in the same way. So that can be demoralizing for people. They're like, why do I need to vote if it doesn't matter? Why should I show up if all the power is concentrated? So that's one feature. A second feature where stigma has been high.
Yeah.
And the cultural work here is huge. And then the third feature that I just want to name is where you are raced ahead. You don't have a long runway before you're going to have a legal and public health crisis. Like, you were right away. There are some states that will come online in the next couple of years. This is a right of way. And so I think a couple of things. I think in the state of Ohio, there has to be deep and rich investment in cultural and narrative conversations. You have to upend the stigma. And no amount of gerrymandering can stop that. I also think people will tell you you cannot win, and you should not believe that. And I say that because all summer long, people kept telling us we couldn't win in Kansas, in Kentucky, and that and the data coming out of Michigan we should ignore. Ignore the people who tell you you can never win. You just have to do the work of organizing. And the last thing is everyone needs to be clear that fights around democracy, fights around voting, fights around being heard are fights around abortion access right now. And so across a range of issues, what does it look like to align around these fundamental power imbalance ideas together in the state? It will not happen fast, and all of that has to happen while you are protecting people, because you can't forget about the people who are in deep harm's way. So you have to have protection plans, but moving forward against the rest.
And let's hope it won't be another 50 years.
It will not be 50 years. Everybody who's saying everything is accelerated, it won't be 50 years, but it also won't be one election cycle. So people have to recommit again and again to this being a part of your life's work.
Well, let's thank Fatima Grace for being here with us today.
We're about to begin the audience Q&A. We welcome questions from everyone, City Club members, guests, students, and those joining via our live stream at cityclub.org. We ask that you keep your questions brief and to the point so that we may incorporate as many questions as we can. If you'd like to tweet a question for our speaker, please tweet it at the City Club. You can also text your question to 330-541-5794. That's 330-541-5794, and our staff will try to work it into the program. May we have the first question, please?
First of all, I'd like to thank you for a very informative presentation and discussion. My question involves legislators and legislations that restrict the access to abortion without regard to the women's health. That's medical nonsense. Has any thought been given to charging those who vote that way with practicing medicine without a license? And I'm being serious, because I think that's just what it is.
You know, I haven't heard it put exactly that way, I will say. But I also think that I've been extremely inspired by the way the medical community has shown up in this time with real clarity on what it is they believe should happen as a matter of health and when they believe they would be in violation of their oaths. And I think states like Ohio run a giant risk of losing medical talent, not just people who perform abortions, medical talent, because if you start here with politically interfering with the ability of people to practice their profession, it raises a giant question of when it will end, where it will end, and whether this is a place they want to be able to call home.
Hi, do you think that there will be a bill or a legislation passed similar to Roe v. Wade, or one that will secure the right throughout the 24-week period that you can get an abortion, or do you think nothing will happen and rules will get, like, more strict?
So are you talking about nationally, or are you talking about here in Ohio, or?
Nationally.
So there's a bill called the Women's Health Protection Act that passed the House with pretty good numbers, and has 49 co-sponsors and votes in the Senate. We will see whether that maybe shifts with the new senators. But as you know, the challenge among moving that forward has been the filibuster, which has been the challenge of moving most things forward. I was about to start ticking them off, but we don't have time. So there is a bill that would do that. And I would say part of our job in educating people, and medical professionals will tell you this, is it's not about a week. That's not how medical professionals think about whether or not a pregnancy is viable. The question that medical professionals ask is whether or not a pregnancy is viable. And so, you know, many people have described the Women's Health Protection Act as a bill that would codify Roe, because it basically would provide that standard that states would have to meet if they were going to pass laws relating to abortion. And that for sure would address many of the problems that we are seeing, including the 6-week ban in Ohio.
Hello, first of all, thank you so much for doing this. As a young woman in Ohio, this is a really important issue to me, so thank you for coming out to do this. My question is about the equal protections. I know when Justice Ginsburg was at the ACLU, she favored an approach to reproductive rights cases that was more equal protections based. Given that these reproductive laws target mainly women, especially women of minorities, do you think that equal protections could be an argument to be made against these laws in future legal challenges?
So that's such a good question. And I will add that Justice Ginsburg, she did make arguments over time around that this was an issue of equality, of fundamental equality. She also supported, of course, the approach in Roe, which relied on personal dignity. The reason I think it's important to name that is that folks on the right have been trying to rewrite history and suggest that Justice Ginsburg did not support Roe, which was not true. And many of us are testing some of these arguments, including under state constitutions, in which case in some places provide even broader protection from the federal constitution. I'll say one more thing about Justice Alito's opinion. He did have language in there saying it's not a matter of equality. That is not the holding of his decision. So that's not the beginning and the end of that question. So that question has not come squarely before the court yet. I believe that access to abortion care is a matter of our ability to be socially, politically, and economically equal in this country. So I agree with you.
Hello, thank you for being here. I am a teacher in Cleveland, and I have two questions for you, but as a teacher, I feel like it's my responsibility. You have a choice. You can name one, you can answer one or both. The question for me, especially, is as politicians are trying to weigh in on what we can talk about in classrooms and what words we can say, is do you have any advice or thoughts on how we can facilitate safe spaces for our students to have these conversations? And my second question is, do you have any advice for all of the young people in this room today in terms of getting involved with and being part of those conversations? Thank you.
Well, I'm so glad you asked about young people here, and I'm so glad there are so many young people here, because I can only imagine at the front of your journey that some of you might be like, I can't believe I have to fight this. So I am with you. But also, yeah, you do, and we're counting on you. And I think your leadership is going to be so critical in mobilizing us, energizing us, and driving us to solutions. So keep getting involved. Join organizations. And understand that this is a part of the path and the work ahead across generations. And then I just want to say a thing about teachers, because I, you know, the last couple of years have been so hard on educators who had to show up during the pandemic in some places in ways that were fundamentally unsafe, who've had to base on attacks on their ability to just sort of teach basic things and are facing legislation that is like, in some cases, just like ridiculous. It's like ridiculous to tell somebody, you know, you can't teach about, you know, I don't know, slavery or the civil rights movement, who are having to deal with so much. And young people are looking to you. And so that I'm hopeful, and there is some work now, that there will be advice on exactly how to provide spaces. We're hearing from a lot of teachers, and what they are saying is young people come to them looking for help, and they want to be sure that they can provide that help. And the last thing I will say about it is, if you find yourself in need of support, there are various legal networks that are coming together to make sure that folks who are helpers in this time, who help young people, who help friends, are supported and resourced.
Good afternoon. So thank you so much for everything that you have shared with us. So I have some advice, I guess. I'm asking for some advice on this. It's kind of around like cross movement. No. It's just around like cross movement education. You kind of hit on some points. And so, like in Ohio, for example, we have a bill in the state house where our legislature have seen what like Kansas and other states have done around passing a constitutional amendment that protects abortion access. And so they're like raising the threshold of a ballot initiative of citizens, for example. And so you have like voter rights groups and democracy groups coming together that are, of course, rallying around this. And then you have the abortion groups, and then you have other groups that are always. But how do you begin that culture change, that education, and those funding issues that sometimes arise to build a movement that is intersectional? And what I mean by that is, like, I remember from when I was working in Repro more heavily, asking some of my friends who would work at a democracy org, like, can you sign on? And they're like, Alana, I want to, but my org cannot sign on to this because of who our funders are. Or, Alana, I love you. Like, I champion this, and I see how this supports us. And we are a pro-union org, and we are unions. But we can't sign in on this because some of our other union members do not support it. How do we begin as movement workers, like, with each other to begin that culture change, that education, and then support each other? Because we also had instances in Ohio where like Repro organizers were sometimes left on the front lines to pick up after an action or something by themselves. They were left behind on their even our own organizations. Like, so how do we begin to even keep each other safe in that way and work together so that we can do that intersectional work of what you talked about earlier?
Yeah, sometimes times of crisis are what make people come together, and that's for sure what has to happen. This is, you know, it may feel like we're fighting 100 fights. We're really fighting one fight in my mind, and that is a fight around democracy and what sort of country we want to be in. And so helping people understand that is hard. I will say this year, the NAACP took a new resolution in support of this issue. In May. In June, the AFL-CIO at its convention took a resolution in support of this issue. There is movement at different parts of our ecosystem with people understanding that this is not a time for us to be siloed. I'm not saying we're not going to continue to bump into problems. We will. But I am seeing more people engaged who before would have said, oh, I have a neutrality position. I just want to be clear, right now there's no such thing. There's no such thing as a neutrality position.
Part of that question also relates to the stigma that we were talking about before. And Fatima and I really wanted to get into a conversation about black women. Yeah. And these two black women on the stage. But black women get abortions too. And the data tells us that black women receive nearly 50% of the abortions in the state of Ohio. Now, we're not quite sure how that... You questioned some of that data. But I think the important part is that we have a stigma in our own community. And with Dobbs, with Heartbeat, we know that black women will be disproportionately affected by these laws. And when we talk about intersection, this is exactly the type of intersection that we need to be very much aware of.
So I two thoughts that I have about it is that the sort of cultural stigma that and assumptions that people can't talk about it or that women, black women haven't had abortions, we actually have to start telling these stories and talking about the reality within communities. So there's some within community work that actually has to happen that is around culture and storytelling and reality across generations of black folks too. But the second piece of that is that there has been so much stigma in providing abortion care is that people have had abortions and not even understood that to be the case.
Right.
You know, and some of that is providers understanding how much stigma and so using other language to talk about a termination, to talk about, you know, using the very technical medical procedural language, and then people look at their medical records and now understand they had an abortion. You know, there have been a lot of people who've talked about how they had ectopic pregnancies and ended their pregnancy, but didn't realize it wasn't an abortion. That's an abortion. But there has been so much stigma and shame, people can't talk about the health care that they have actually needed, and that, I will just tell you, is dangerous. It is dangerous in a time where healthcare is accessible, but it is especially dangerous for people to be afraid to get the care they need or to seek support. And, you know, as these states are racing forward with laws, including laws that have criminal penalties for providers, but criminal penalties for people who self-manage abortion care or help others, I'm really clear who's going to be in the way of those criminal penalties. That is going to be black women. Mm-hmm. And we have to take that on head on. We can't, our communities need to have a conversation around whether we want to increase a police state around health care that was totally and fundamentally legal as a part of our core constitutional liberties for 50 years. That's what's on the table.
And we also know healthcare disparities. I mean, all of this snowballs into so many aspects of our own health. Maternal mortality, right?
That's right.
Healthcare disparities. Food instability or insecurity. There's so much that's involved in whether our lawmakers are really looking at the various aspects that this will affect, and how do you increase those supports? I'm sure your organization is looking at that and how to advocate for families that will now need increased wages, affordable child care, affordable health care, all of the things that we think about that just have been snowballed. You know, the whole effects will snowball into those types of things.
I mean, it is not lost on me that in the same year the Dobbs decision came down, the child tax credit was not extended, and we did not get the investment in care infrastructure, including in child care or including paid leave, that would have made a giant difference in people's lives. And, you know, I have been extremely frustrated by some states that have said, okay, well, it's almost like they didn't have a plan. Well, now I guess we can invest more in families. Families needed investment before the Dobbs decision. Right. And so I don't, I'm really frustrated by it, but I do know that we have another dozen states that are likely to race and try to ban abortion in this next state session. It is only going to accelerate, and our families will be in trouble.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Alyssa, thank you.
Thank you, Fatima Goss-Graves and Helen Forbes-Fields. We appreciate you both so much. Today's forum is the David Ralph Hertz Memorial Forum on Civil Liberties. Mr. Hertz was a lawyer, judge, and community leader in Cleveland for more than 60 years. He joined the City Club in 1923 and was active in the American Civil Liberties Union, representing the ACLU in a number of civil liberties cases in Cleveland. His grandson, David Hertz, is here today and is a longtime member of the City Club as well. We are honored that he is with us in the audience with his wife, Beth, and stepmother, Colette. Thank you for your continued support of the City Club. We would also like to welcome guests at tables hosted by the Center for Community Solutions, Charles F. Brush High School, Hawken, MC Squared STEM High School, Planned Parenthood of Greater Ohio, Shaker Heights High School, Social Venture Partners Cleveland, Success Academy, and the YWCA of Greater Cleveland. Thank you for being here with us today. This Friday, December 2nd, we welcome Carrie Jaros to the City Club. She is President and Chief Executive Officer of Gojo Industries, maker of Purell. And just announced, Kyle Dreyfus-Wells, CEO of the Northeast Ohio Regional Sewer District, will join us on Friday, December 16th. You can learn more about these forums and others on our website, cityclub.org. And that brings us to the end of today's forum. Thank you once again to Helen and Fatima, and thank you, members and friends of the City Club. I'm Alyssa Raybuck, and this forum is now adjourned.
For information on upcoming speakers or for podcasts of the City Club, go to cityclub.org.
Production and distribution of City Club Forums on IdeaStream Public Media are made possible by PNC and the United Black Fund of Greater Cleveland Incorporated.